At 25 minutes after the hour, it's time to greet Dr. Don Clark. Don from Garden Valley, Texas, biochemist and pharmaceutical veteran. Would that be true? I mean, that's true, but...
I was in the biotechnology industry for a while, biopharmaceuticals.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And then you said, what am I doing here? I think I'll move to Texas and start a winery.
Well, actually, I was in Texas with a biopharmaceutical company, a small biopharmaceutical company, and then we got bought out by a larger company in New Jersey, and then I worked with them remotely, for a while.
Now, is that one of the companies that's working on the vaccine or doing test trials, or is that something else?
I don't think they're actually working on anything related to the COVID. I could be wrong, but I haven't kept up with them since leaving them back in 2000.
Yeah, it seems like I've every other day I hear about some new company that's working on a virus vaccine.
Well,
that
turns out there are thousands of them around the world and in the country. I didn't realize that we had so many labs. We're learning a lot. In fact, we were talking with Don in his biochemical expertise last week about the coronavirus, and Don did some interesting statistical tracking and had some interesting, by the way, everybody wants to catch that discussion, it's in our podcast archives from last week, and go up to just where it says podcasts on our brokenroadradio.com homepage, and then click on Don's name, and it'll be there at the top of the list. Interesting discussion. But in times past, Don, and we've talked about these topics over 7-8 years now, weekly, scientific research, scientific data, scientific methods, it seems like the impression we have, and especially now with hearing about all these labs and research and accelerating vaccine development, we have this image of science as so precise, so exacting, and so right all the time. And yet when it comes to something like the age of a dinosaur, accuracy seems to be not so highly prized, and we settle for less. Explain how that works.
Well, yes, you may recall, and we've talked about it on this program several times, that soft tissue was discovered in dinosaurs, in the particular dinosaur bones or the horn of a triceratops, for example. And everybody's saying, well, how can that soft tissue be if the dinosaur is 68 million plus years old? I mean, surely that soft tissue would have degraded by this time. And so they put, for the most part, most folks put their trust in the radiometric dating that they were using to date the dinosaur bones in the dinosaur fossils, as opposed to actually looking through a electron microscope at the soft tissue to see what the soft tissue was. And as it turned out, it wasn't bacteria, it wasn't fungus, it was actually... in some cases, osteocytes, which are bone making cells, and blood vessels and things like that. So it was actual tissue from the dinosaur itself, as opposed to something contaminating the specimen. You know, of course, we've got bacteria and fungus all over the place, so you would expect to find some of that. But this was actual dinosaur tissue. So you had a contradiction, if you will. One method is telling you that, hey, this is really, really old. Another method is saying, maybe not so much. It wasn't just like a factor of 10. We're talking about, well, you know, this specimen probably can't be more than a couple of thousand years, maybe... 4,000, 5,000 years old at the most, and the radiometric dating is saying at 68, 70 million years old. So how do you reconcile the two? Well, one is your assumption about the dinosaur. I mean, our assumption is that the dinosaurs lived a long time ago, And the reason why we have that assumption is because the radiometric dating process was done first. And
but
so,
see, that's not done on the dinosaur stuff, is it? It's done on the rock surrounding the fossil or the bones. So it's indirect, is it not?
Oh, it's very much indirect because it's they didn't do carbon dating. Carbon dating is good to about 50,000 years or so. After that, you don't have very much. You know, carbon-14 and carbon, and it degrades into nitrogen, I believe. You don't have any of that left to really measure anything. It's about 10 half-lives that you can go back. And so they say, well, you know, no sense doing the carbon dating. We're just going to date the, and they're not even dating the rocks. I mean, in a sense, they're dating the rock, the ash, if you will, the volcanic ash above and below, if there's volcanic layers, the layer, the sedimentary layer that the dinosaur bones were found in. Now, it's interesting that it was a sedimentary layer. That should tell you something. That should tell you that the dinosaur was buried and other fossils are buried in some type of cataclysm in this case. So we know as a creation scientist that the cataclysm was probably the global flood. And as we've talked multiple times before in this program, that, you know, if you had tsunamis that, let's say, were up in the order of seven to 800 feet high, that it would be causing a tremendous amount of silt and pulverizing rock and not only wiping out life as we know it on the earth, but putting all kinds of sediment, laying all kinds of sediment across the continent. And this is exactly what we find when we, you know, look at the continents. Back in, from a geological point of view, you find all kinds of sediment and all kinds of layers. And in some of those layers are, we've got, you know, dinosaur bones and fish bones and all kinds of other things kind of mixed in, as you would expect if you had just think of even just a 30-foot tsunami coming on to shore. When you have an 800-foot or a 700-foot tsunami coming on the shore, how much more damaging that's going to be. And what you're going to find at the end is not a nice organized structure, but it's going to be just like, oh, gee, here's a graveyard of bones. They're kind of all mixed up. And if an animal was lucky, maybe all the bones are together. But for the most part, they're probably all scrambled up.
Let me ask this question then, because if there is a layer full of different life forms and plant matter, for that matter, that has been fossilized and encased in a layer of sediment someplace, and in this case, this dinosaur, this Triceratops, was in Montana, which is hardly ever thought of as a coastline. I mean, one, that water and the sediment washed inland, probably through water channels, rivers going backwards and lakes filling up and so forth. But if you have this mixture of life, it's likely they all didn't die at the same time, isn't it? I mean, some of those could have been fossilized even before the flood. But the point is they're all mixed up, and science is giving a uniform interpretation of these all died at the same time in that layer. That's not necessarily the case, is it?
It might be. It depends on the layer. I mean, you say that, okay, Montana's pretty far inland. Well, you got to remember the flood was a global flood, and it covered every dry land that there was. Mm-hmm. So it was covered in water at some point in time, and then you know, things were washed as the caverns of the deep, you know, were created, as Genesis says, and the waters started to recede off the land. You had subsequent, you know, major shiftings of water and sediment during that process. But in order to have a, in order to fossilize anything, and especially to fossilize it in its original form, for example, whether it be a tree leaf or whether it be a, you know, a, an insect or whatever it happens to be, you know, it's got to be buried in mud so that it is not exposed to oxygen, not exposed to bacteria, which normally would break all of those things down. A lot of people, there was a conception that the fossilized bones, for example, oh, you know, these creatures settled to the bottom of the ocean, and over time, you know, silt covered it, and there you have it. Well, you know, first of all, if a fish dies in some water, it doesn't settle to the bottom. It floats to the top, and it gets chewed up by either other fish or by bacteria or other, you know, organisms, and you don't have much left to settle down to the bottom of your lake or whatever it happens to be. So to get a nice fossil, it has to be covered pretty much instantaneously with a mud or a silt layer, and the best way to describe that is through a cataclysmic event like the flood, which is bringing in multiple layers different density of sand and silt to cover the animal or the plant that you find as a fossil. So the best model to describe, you know, they actually make a point in this particular article that we date the volcanic ash that's, you know, either above or below these layers, these sedimentary layers. Well, the best model is the creation model, because at the time, before the flood, for example, the Earth was one major landmass. You know, it's been called Pangaea. And then Pangaea broke up. And what happens when continents break up? A lot of volcanic activity occurs. So as you are breaking up the continents, and as things are really getting stirred up, and you had water is coming from the deep, and of course rain coming down, you know, so that the earth was covered, it rained for 40 days, and water was coming up, so that every possible landmass was covered. You also had the continents breaking up. Well, as the continents were breaking up, more volcanic activity happened, and so you would wind up with exactly what you find is sedimentary layers with volcanic ash either above it or below it, and then more sedimentary layers and more ash, volcanic you know, material, because that's what was happening at the time of the flood. And so our continents didn't get formed until that time, and it took probably, the estimates anywhere between 500 and 700 years after the flood, the continents were still, you know, moving apart and was still settling down. And this whole process then helps to explain the ice ages, that the ice age, or ages, if you will, that we had that actually followed the flood. It wasn't pre-flood, and it wasn't millions and millions of years ago, as was supposed. It was at the time, I mean, you know, relatively speaking, within 1,000 years of the flood, that we had the ice age and the subsequent carvings of the Grand Canyon, for example, through many local floods that wiped or swept away a lot of this light sedimentary material to form the Grand Canyon and the Bryce Canyon and the canyons that we see today out in the West. So
let me ask another question. First, I want to mention to people, if you'd like to consult the article online that we're talking about, there's a link in the chat window at brokenroadradio.com. It's that bottom blue type there. Click on that. It'll take you right to the article, How Stuff Works, online. You can kind of read along with us and see this for yourself. But, Don, I'm thinking, if radioisotope dating is used on sediment layers, does that not tell you when, you mentioned that data is accurate. It tells you when that material was first formed, not necessarily when it got to that location. So it seems to me there's another error factor built in there. I mean, if you age a rock, you're finding out how old it was or how long ago it was formed into a rock from lava or whatever other material, from pressure, sedimentary rock, that kind of thing. So you're finding out when it was formed, not when it arrived to its present location. So lots can happen in between the time a rock is made into a rock and the time scientists find it years later.
Well, there's a lot of assumptions in radiometric dating, for example. And one of the assumptions is that, okay, we have a parent isotope, like uranium. Uranium ultimately degrades into lead, for example. So one of the assumptions that can be made is that I just have the parent isotope at the beginning. And whatever lead molecules or atoms that I find are a result of degradation since that rock was formed. It's not from residual lead that it might have been in the mineral initially. And so there you are artificially, if you will, making an assumption that, okay, there's no lead there, so all the lead that I find is the result of the time that passed since this rock or this layer was formed and my measurement, let's say. So you have that assumption, you come up with, you know what the half-life of uranium is down to lead, and you say, okay, I've got this percentage of lead versus this amount of uranium, so therefore it is this old based on the half-life. And there's a simple calculation that you can do in order to figure that out. Well, if the basic assumption is wrong, that there was no lead there to begin with, in other words, that, well, perhaps there was a lot of lead there to begin with, then that calculation gets thrown out of the window. Or if you even say, I don't know how much lead was there at the beginning, so therefore you can't do the calculation, right? So it's like, what are you actually dating? What are you actually doing by using this dating method? The dating method, assumes that two things. One, either I know what the starting materials were, what the ratio of the starting materials were, in this case, uranium and lead. Either I know what that is, and I know what I have now. The only thing you know is really what you have now. You don't know how much was there at the start. And so that's a big problem with radiometric dating, is that you don't necessarily know how much you had back then. The other thing you don't know is, is this pristine? In other words, has there been any contamination or washing away of materials that can cause a miscalculation based on the amount that you're finding today? The only thing you know is the amount that you found when you took the sample. You don't know, like I said, what those amounts were at another point.
It sounds to me like the result of all that is a really rough average of what might have been the age of some of the material. Is there no way to refine that? And the other question is, is carbon dating accurate at all? It's only good back till about 50,000 years. Why not take this dinosaur specimen, whether it's soft tissue or a bone, and do carbon dating on it? Is it not reliable?
Well, carbon dating has been done on it subsequent to the soft tissue findings, and they find that, hey, this isn't that old after all. And so, so this whole business of well, we'll just take the igneous rock layer above the sediment, because you can't do it in a sediment layer. It's they don't have the radioisotopes that you need, and it's more fluid, if you will, the fluid in a solid sense. Then the volcanic ash or the volcanic material that you know is there, and so there's a big problem with this, and so their conclusion is out of all of this is you know, these dinosaurs aren't that old. Anyway, they're not 68 million years old. They're you know, they're probably in the 4,000 to 5,000 year range, which puts it right in the middle of the flood. And so if we go back to Genesis, if we look in our history book, our very accurate history book, as to when these things took place and what actually happened, and read it from a more literal, you know, point of view, as opposed to, oh, this is just a nice story that we can then, you know, build up a nice, you know, story for kids, and have all the animals on this this ark, and then tell the story of Noah, of you know, Noah and the flood, but not really believe it. And not really believe that that was only about 4,500 years ago, and not something that was sometime in the ancient past. And oh, by the way, it was a local flood, not a global flood type of thing. You know, you get, and if you completely ignore it, you know, you get results like this. Oh, the dinosaurs are 68 million years old. And then you got contradictory information saying that, man, no, they're not.
What happens to a scientist who assents to that? Okay, I'll take the carbon dating, 4,500 years for this dinosaur specimen, and I'll publish it. What risk, what risk do they run?
Ostracized. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, he gets, your results have to be, can't be accurate, because we know, everybody knows that dinosaurs are, you know, millions and millions, tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of years old. And so you obviously have the wrong answer, and nobody's going to publish your data. If you keep pushing on the issue and keep going against the grain, you get ostracized.
So the result is that this is settled science, when in reality there should be no such thing as settled science. It should always be subject to revision and updating and new data, correct?
That's correct. Yep. I mean, how can we know for certain, you know, really anything in science? Okay, there are certain principles. That's the thing. I mean, when in science you take observations, or you come up with some mathematical theory or, you know, construct, if you will. But let's say you have some observations. Okay, I'm looking at this data, and now I want to have a predictive model for what the data is showing me. Then you come up with assumptions, which is called an hypothesis. And then you test your hypothesis, and if other scientists test the hypothesis, and you have a theory or you have a hypothesis that, you know, such and such happened, and this is the reason why we're getting the results that we're getting. After a lot of people have done it, it then becomes a theorem, which is pretty well accepted as that particular model must be correct, because a lot of people have done the experiment and they came up with the same answer. The problem is, of course, with evolution and this type of stuff. I mean, yes, you could do these experiments all day, and you could take, you know, the same type of sediment layer or the same type of igneous layer, the volcanic layer, test it around the world, and you may get the very similar results to 68, 70, you know, 100 million years and say, aha, you see, the result is consistent. There's nothing consistent. I mean, yes, you're consistently making the same error over and over and over again. You consistently have the wrong assumptions. But when you have data that is contradictory to your original assumptions, then you've got to relook at that and say, maybe what I'm doing is not correct.
Yeah, maybe scientists can still learn something from time to time.
Have you? Is it time? You started the music already. Have you heard from Mark Armitage? Do you know? He's the guy that discovered soft tissue and dinosaur bones in South Dakota.
Yeah, we had him on the air with us with Don several years ago.
Now, have you heard anything more about him?
I haven't. No.
Okay. I know he was let go from his university position for his beliefs, for publicizing and publishing his findings, and was later reinstated. That's about all I know. But we could look him up. Mark Armitage is the scientist out in Southern California, Northridge College in Northridge, California. So anyway, that's worth checking on. Maybe we can give him a call or something, find out what's going on these days. Don Clark, a member of the board of Creation Moments. You can check their website at creationmoments.com. You'll find a resource there, a wealth of resources that support the biblical story of creation, scientific information that says that's the way it happened. Oh, great surprise to much of science. Don, we'll see you next week. Thanks for spending time with us today. See ya.
Oh, quite welcome.
Thanks, Don.
Come on.